Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Our guest today oversees 4,600 miles of state roads, 99 miles of state turnpikes, hundreds of state bridges, in addition to snow plowing, culvert maintenance. And right now it's construction season, as orange cones and detour signs are a frequent sight on Granite State highways and byways this time of year. We're sitting down this hour with New Hampshire Department of Transportation Commissioner Victoria Sheehan to talk about our transportation infrastructure and take your questions. So let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Commissioner Sheehan, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Good morning, Laura. Thank you for having me back. It's great to be here.
Well, I mentioned the culvert maintenance and it's road construction season. How has this very wet spring, Commissioner Sheehan, affected your ability to keep up with all the maintenance?
It has been a struggle. After a long winter where our forces worked numerous storm events, especially north of Concord, where we had a significant amount of snow this year, to then have a wet spring, that definitely sets us behind as we try to tackle all of our maintenance and construction projects this year.
How does it set you behind? In what way?
We have a very robust paving program. We've been fortunate because of the additional revenue provided by the gas tax increase. We've been able to do more paving across the state, and our forces are trying to get out ahead of the paving and upgrade pipes and do a lot of the work that is necessary before the paving contractors perform their aspect of the project. And so the springtime is very busy for us. We want to get as much work accomplished as possible so that we're ready to take advantage of the summer construction season.
So if you're trying to repair a culvert or some of the underground pipes that manage water near or under the roads, they're full of water. It makes it harder to fix those, and then you can't get to the paving. So everything kind of gets set back.
Everything gets set back, and it is a challenge. We've had, like I said, a very severe winter, and so snow melt and then heavy rainfall. That just makes it much more challenging for us to do our work.
Well, and just to clarify, Commissioner Sheehan, what does your department do? And just as important, what doesn't it do? Because I'm guessing you guys get lots of calls from people upset about, you know, potholes and frosties on their local roads.
So in your introduction, you talked a lot about what we do from a highway perspective. And yes, we are the highway division. We are responsible for 4,600 lane miles of highway. But there are a number of roads in the state that we're not responsible for. We work really closely with municipalities who are doing the maintenance and upkeep of some of the low volume roadways in communities. That being said, the DOT does own a lot of different types of roadway, from our interstates to some of the local roads. And in many cases, your main street is a state highway. And so it depends on the community, what our relationship is with that city or town.
Oh, that's interesting. So in some towns, Main Street is also Route 3.
Correct. But that's the highway side of the house. We are a multimodal DOT. And we also work closely with all of the airports in the state, as well as the transit providers and the rail operators. We're in the fortunate position that we receive federal funding for all of these different types of transportation, and many of those dollars flow through the department and are prioritized through our 10-year planning process. And so we have really strong partnerships with all the different modes of transportation, even though the majority of our workforce at DOT is dedicated to maintaining and constructing our highway system.
Well, a little bit later, we'll definitely talk about bus and rail because we always get lots of questions from listeners about that. But just a little bit more on the department and what it does and how it all shakes out, Commissioner Sheehan, where does most of the money for New Hampshire's transportation infrastructure, so everything, not just roads, where does that come from?
So there's really three sources of funding. There's the federal programs, there's the turnpike system, and then we have state funding for transportation. And one of the presentations we do when we're trying to orient newly elected officials who are working with us on both the 10-year plan and our budget is on the colors of money. And because there's different rules around how we can spend those dollars and what types of projects are eligible. And so through the 10-year plan process, we're trying to prioritize our projects based on the available funding. And so that can sometimes be confusing for people to understand. There might be a really high need, but we don't have the appropriate color of money to be able to advance that project.
So we're on the radio, we can't see colors, but go ahead, give us a little bit more on that. So for example, you can't use turnpike money,
correct,
toll money to fix something in another part of the system.
That
go ahead.
Correct. The turnpike is an enterprise, and so we collect toll revenue, and that supports both the operations, the maintenance, and then ultimately that provides the funding for any widening or expansion projects that we want to do in the turnpike system. But those dollars can't be used elsewhere in the state. And likewise, some of the federal programs have very specific rules around how you can use those proceeds. And so we have, you know, a plethora of different types of programs, from the Transportation Alternatives Program targeting complete streets and multimodal approaches to transportation. And then we have our traditional federal funding that helps us maintain our road and bridge infrastructure. And then likewise, the transit dollars really can't be used for anything other than transit purposes. And obviously, we get money from the Federal Aviation Administration that has to go towards airports. And so we are prioritizing projects within these different categories when we work through the 10-year plan process.
So there may be an extreme need in one area, but you can't pull funding from another area to address that extreme need.
That's correct.
By the way, turnpikes. So some people may not quite know what that is. So what are the turnpikes or the toll roads here in New Hampshire?
And so we have three different sections of turnpike. We have the F.E. Everett Turnpike that goes from Nashua up to Concord. And so that's what people consider to be F.E. Everett plus a portion of 93. And then we have over on the seacoast, the Blue Star Turnpike, which is essentially I-95. And then we have the Spalding Turnpike, which is Route 16.
Okay. And so 93 is a little bit turnpike.
93 from the merge with 293 and 93 up to Concord is part of the turnpike system. But 93, sort of south of Manchester, is not part of the turnpike.
What kind of a difference, Commissioner Sheehan, has open road tolling played in some of these turnpikes that we have, where you just, you know, scoot through and you don't have to stop? I have family in Manchester, so I drive through that open road tolling in 93 all the time. It's wonderful. I don't have any backups, but I just wonder what impact that has had financially on our turnpike system.
Well, there's both safety benefits as well as operational benefits, especially at our plazas where we had long delays on the weekend with a number of visitors coming to the state. And so open road tolling has really helped us improve that driver experience, and you can get to your destination much more quickly and easily. As I mentioned, it does improve safety as well, because people can then move at highway speeds. We don't have as much traffic going through a traditional toll lane.
Yeah, I think there was a terrible crash at the 93 tolls in Hooksett several years ago before open road tolling, because people are slowing down. There are those toll booths. There's big cement barriers in between each one. So that seems...
And this is why the industry is interested in moving towards all electronic tolling. Now that the technology has advanced, because of the safety benefits, I think every state across the country that has a turnpike system is looking at whether or not all electronic tolling is appropriate for their system.
One more question about money, Commissioner Sheehan. I'm sure this will come up throughout the hour, but specifically, your department says that the state's highway fund is, quote, structurally insolvent. So what does that mean exactly?
So it's the fact that everyone is driving more fuel-efficient vehicles today than they were 10, 15, 20 years ago. And as electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles become more prevalent on our roadways, that will mean we have to change how we fund transportation, because at the moment we're reliant primarily on gas tax revenue and on vehicle registrations to fund our transportation system. And so we have been working with the legislature to educate on this issue. It's something that both our legislature here in New Hampshire as well as Congress are grappling with, because long-term, as these shifts occur, we need to think about the appropriate way to fund our transportation systems.
So as people drive more fuel-efficient vehicles, they are paying less gas taxes because they're just buying less gas. Great for them, great for the environment, but not so great for your bottom line.
That's correct. Although at the same time, we've been able to work with the legislature, and when there was one-time revenue available, we've been able to take advantage of that. And so the legislature and the governor have supported using general fund revenue to fund transportation. So traditionally, we relied on specific sources of funding, but we have been able to advocate and receive funding from other sources of revenue, such as general funds.
So is that sustainable?
That is what is being evaluated. And at the federal level, the same thing has happened. To fund the last finance bill for infrastructure, they also moved general funds into the Highway Trust Fund. And so there's a lot of conversation happening at the moment about, like I said before, the appropriate way to fund transportation going forward. And there's a lot of debate over whether or not we should be entertaining new ways of paying for transportation, such as vehicle miles traveled or some kind of road user fee. But there's been some pilots and not necessarily enough results to help our elected officials feel comfortable that we have the right path forward at this time.
I remember some of those debates in other states and in New Hampshire about vehicle miles traveled, user fees and so forth. But just explain how those work, Commissioner Sheehan, because a lot of people don't understand quite how that would work.
So it depends on the type of technology that is adopted. In some cases, we'd be tracking vehicle miles traveled, whether that's done through vehicle inspection and registration, or whether there's actually a device in a vehicle tracking how far you travel in a year. And there's different potential technology solutions. But the idea is that you'd pay for your use of the system. The more you travel, the more that you would contribute to the upkeep of our roads and our systems. Alternatively, there's proposals such as road usage fee, which would be essentially a registration surcharge to make up the difference. And that if you're paying less in gas tax revenue, you pay a little bit more in vehicle registration. The legislature has been looking at all of these different alternatives. And so we're, as a department, trying to support them as they evaluate what is the best solution for us in New Hampshire.
How do you make that evaluation? There's a lot of judgments and opinions and so forth.
Well, that's the great thing about living in New Hampshire. We have a robust public process. And so our legislature has had a number of hearings when these bills are put forward. This summer, the legislature has retained two bills this session, and the department will be working to support the legislature once again as we try to address the questions that come up through the public hearing process.
What does that mean, bills were retained? You're going to study the issue, but the bill wasn't killed outright?
Yeah, they retained the bill so we could do further study because they really aren't sure whether or not we're ready to move forward with any of the solutions that are currently on the table.
I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. The number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. We're sitting down with New Hampshire's Transportation Commissioner, Victoria Sheehan, this hour. We're talking about the state's I-93 expansion project, also the 10-year highway plan, and other transportation priorities. And we'd like to hear from you. What do you think the state's top transportation priorities should be? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. It's your chance to talk with New Hampshire's Transportation Commissioner. And Commissioner Sheehan, I wanted to ask you about an article that was on the front page of the Union Leader on Sunday about a type of guardrail called ET+. According to the article, new installations of these have been banned for the last 4 or 5 years because they don't work properly. They've caused or are blamed to have caused severe injuries. So no more new installations. But what about getting rid of the 3,000 units that the article says still exist around the state? Is that a priority?
So we are working to replace those units. As we have accidents on the highway and sections of guardrail are damaged, we replace those with the latest technology. Likewise, as we're completing our construction projects, whether that's widening corridors or doing routine paving, we try to address any guardrail that needs to be improved as part of that work.
So it's ongoing?
Ongoing, correct.
The goal is to ultimately rip up these 3,000 units and replace them with something better.
Just like the safety features on your vehicle have improved over the years, a lot of the hardware and roadside devices that we use have also improved over time. And so as a department, we strive to keep current with the latest technologies and do everything that we can to improve safety. And so as part of our standard process, we try to always upgrade any of our roadside features to make sure that they're latest, and we're taking advantage of changes in the industry and safety improvements that have been implemented.
Well, and since we're talking about safety, now I know the Department of Safety is more in charge of tracking fatalities on our roadways, but I would like to ask you just one or two questions about this, because the numbers are quite concerning. As you know, Commissioner Sheehan, a large jump in motor vehicle fatal crashes in recent years, 147 deaths last year in New Hampshire, way up from just 4 years prior where there were 95 deaths. What do you think is going on?
We do work very closely with Department of Safety, and we do review all of the crash data that they supply. One of the bills that's working through the legislature this year is concerning releasing crash information to DOT earlier so that we have more real-time information concerning the circumstances of a crash, because we want to understand whether there's anything that we could do to improve that roadway to make it safer in the future. But it's clear that this uptick is driven by human behavior, whether that's speed, distracted driving, driving impaired, and that's what we're seeing across the country. And so we're trying to work with Department of Safety on messaging and how we can bring awareness to these issues, as well as do what we can as a department to make sure that we're taking advantage of the latest safety technologies and looking at roadway geometry to see if there's things that we can do. I will say, often after a crash, a community is advocating strongly that we do something immediately.
There could changing be, the roadway and the way it's configured.
There can be unintended consequences. And so we want to make sure that before we implement a change, we're really certain that that's going to solve the problem. And that could be frustrating for folks, especially when we're dealing with a community where somebody close to them has tragically lost their life. And so we want to make sure that we truly are making things better. And that means we collect a lot of information. Like I said, we look at the crash data to understand what the best possible way forward is going to be.
How do you discern how much of a problem is due to the highway itself, the way it's configured, the way it's painted, the way the exits and the entrances are, and how much is due just to the way people are driving now? You know, driving at 40 miles an hour, 50 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour, staring at their phones. You see it all the time. One hand on the wheel, one hand with the phone.
So we perform what we call road safety audits at the request of communities and working with the regional planning commissions. And we're looking at that crash data and the circumstances of the accidents, and then also looking at the roadway geometry, the signage, how that roadway was striped, and trying to understand if there's anything that we can do to improve safety.
So I remember, for example, again, Route 9 West is a road that I happen to travel a lot. You guys put in rumble strips recently on a particularly dangerous stretch of that road called Death Alley, I think. And I think I read, Commissioner Sheehan, that that has made a big difference. Just rumble strips, pretty basic.
Rumble strips are a low-cost installation that can have dramatic results in terms of improving safety. Rumble strips are really trying to ensure that we keep vehicles on the road in the correct lane, that if you are distracted or you take your eyes off the road just for a second, you're alerted that you're leaving that lane and can recover and prevent, in particular, head-on crashes.
All right. Coming up, we'll talk a lot more with Transportation Commissioner Sheehan. We'll look a little bit more at this issue of the structural deficit in the highway fund, and we'll talk about how New Hampshire's workforce shortage is affecting DOT's ability to maintain roads, remove snow, make progress on some of the big projects. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The main reason I decided to incorporate NHPR into my estate planning is because it absolutely is an essential part of my day.
Robert Cody of Deerfield.
Doing so with an IRA account is a very tax-efficient way of transferring your assets to the future.
Fund the future of NHPR by naming us as a beneficiary to your IRA. Learn more about this and other plan giving options at nhpr.giveplans.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, a conversation with Department of Transportation Commissioner Victoria Sheehan. which roads and bridges on your commute need some attention? Should New Hampshire invest in commuter rail, bus service, or focus on our major roads? What gaps in transit in our state do you see? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Use Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Commissioner Sheehan, a couple emails coming in. Michael asks, what percentage of our road traffic is out of state, and what's the strategy to recapture the lost gas tax revenue from out-of-state drivers? Otto has a similar question, so I'll ask that one too. He says, have you put any thought into how DOT will handle the decreased revenue from electric vehicles not paying gas taxes when they become more prevalent? So two questions about, again, that lost gas tax revenue.
So the two issues raised by your listeners speak to the lack of information that we have and our inability at times to answer the questions that come up as we debate how to move forward. We actually, as a department, just received a federal grant to do some additional analysis, specifically around where our revenue comes from, what percentage is in-state versus out-of-state gas tax, for example. During the last federal financing bill, there was a lot of discussion around how we could encourage states to pilot more initiatives around alternatives to gas tax revenue. And so New Hampshire submitted an application to access some of those funds, and we'll be doing a lot of work this spring and summer in preparation for our conversations with the legislature in the fall.
Oh, that's interesting. So it sounds like some ideas will be put on the table for finding some new alternative to this gas tax revenue problem.
And we're hoping that we can provide some additional information to the legislature so they understand where the revenue is coming from today. And then hopefully that will help them establish a better path forward.
All right. Well, you'll have to come back and talk to us about that, because I know it's an issue that this state is struggling with, but states all over the country.
This is a national debate, correct?
Yeah. Again, great for the environment, great for air quality, but not so great for highway coffers. Let's go back to our listeners, Commissioner Sheehan. And again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. And Nadia is calling from Nashua. Hi, Nadia. Thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Commissioner Sheehan, I'm not certain if this is an area you cover, but at least in Nashua, during the winter time, the city tends to plow all of the snow into every available handicap parking spot, making them unusable for the people to use those spots. And I would like to see the city shovel out the bus stops, because I often see like women with children having to stand in the street, you know, amongst the slush and ice, cars whizzing by. And my last point is, I was born and raised in Massachusetts, and the residents there are required to shovel the sidewalks in front of their houses, and if they don't, they incur a fine. I would like to see that instituted here, because I live on a very busy street, and I'm always seeing that people have to walk in the street,
yeah,
in the winter.
Yeah, that's unnerving, isn't it, Nadia? I hear you on that. This is probably more a question for the mayor of Nashua, but there are always frustrations, Commissioner Sheehan, with the way that plows do their work.
These are more city and town issues. DOT is not responsible for sidewalks, but we do hear about these concerns often, especially when we're talking about providing access for all to our infrastructure. I don't envy our plow drivers. At the end of the day, their primary responsibility is to clear the roadways and keep them open. But I know that the communities work diligently to get out and clear the sidewalks as quickly as they can after a storm event. And in some communities, they focus their efforts on clearing handicapped spaces and transit bus stops as well. And so it really is a local issue you need to raise with your own community. But we have to be realistic. At the end of the day, it's going to take time after a storm to recover. And when we have one of those winters where we have storm after storm, It's extremely challenging for our communities to keep pace.
Well, Nadia, thank you for the call. And it is frustrating for people to have things plowed and not the way that works for people, especially who are on foot, as Nadia says. And I did want to ask you about winter maintenance, so I'm glad she called. Your department is asking for $8 million more dollars a year from the state for winter highway maintenance. So what's the full picture there, Commissioner Sheehan? Because we hear that winters are getting shorter and milder, so less plowing seems necessary.
So our winters in New Hampshire have been unpredictable the last several years. But the amount of snowfall is not necessarily representative of how severe the winter was from DOT's perspective. We've had a lot of wet weather this winter and temperatures right around freezing, which means we have to treat the roadways. And while there's not, you know, a lot of snow in your backyard to show for it, we have spent a lot of time and resources keeping up with winter maintenance activities. And then north of Concord, we did have a severe winter with a lot of snowfall. As a state, we didn't have a significant number of large events, but we had minor events night after night, and our forces were really challenged to keep up.
I've also heard people say, people in roads and electricity infrastructure say, you know, I'd rather take 10 inches of snow than an inch of ice, because ice is problematic.
That is true. We'd all rather have a nice, dry, fluffy snow that we can plow without having to put down much salt, rather than an ice event, which is much more challenging for us.
Well, Nadia, thank you very much for the call. And let's take another one. Bernie is calling from Hollis. Hi, Bernie. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you very much, Laura.
Sure.
My question is about the paint used for road striping. I wonder if over the past couple of decades it has changed, because it seems to me that in the especially rainy nights, it's much less visible, much less reflective than it used to be. Any comments?
Thank you so much, Bernie, for the comment. And I know some of the road striping paint does seem more reflective than others. So go ahead.
The paint products that we use today are different than those we used several years ago. With
really?
Changes in environmental standards, the paint products have evolved. And some of them, we don't get the same level of performance. But that's why we try to go out and stripe our roadways annually. Although that can be a challenge, especially the years when we have a lot of rainfall. Just trying to keep up if Mother Nature isn't cooperating is challenging.
Like this year, for example. That's going to get in the way of you re-striping the roads.
Yeah. And when we have a very robust paving program, we need to complete the paving work, and then we go out to do the striping. And so if we get a lot of wet weather, then we're trying to do striping in the late summer and fall, which is not ideal conditions either. So we really are weather dependent in terms of our productivity and how much we can accomplish.
So Bernie's not imagining things. The paint is less reflective than it used to be.
It's different paint today than it was, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. Yes.
Wow. And in an aging state like New Hampshire, I think we're second or third oldest now in the nation, your eyesight starts to go when you get older often. I wonder if you want to rethink the paint, because you're going to have all these older drivers driving at night, and they might need a little brighter.
We are using the best products that are available. But in addition to that, you'll see we're upgrading our signs, because over time they lose their retro-reflectivity, as we call it. And then we're also putting out delineators and other features on the roadsides that help identify where the edge of the pavement is. There's many different ways that we can help people navigate in poor weather.
Given the success of the rumble strips that we talked about earlier on Route 9, are there more plans, Commissioner Sheehan, to put rumble strips in elsewhere in the state, especially given these terrible traffic fatality numbers that we're seeing?
The department has been updating our rumble strip guidelines. We have been following closely what other states across the country are doing. And there has been some concerns in communities where rumble strips being struck frequently creates a noise nuisance. And so we're trying to balance this need to improve safety, but also to be sensitive to the communities that are dealing with some of the unintended consequences from a noise perspective. So we have been looking at new design alternatives. They talk about mumble strips, which is a different design of rumble strip that you can mill that's a little bit quieter, but still alerts the driver when they're crossing the center line. And so our guidelines are being updated as we learn more from our neighboring states and from others across the country.
Wow. You learn something new every day, Commissioner Sheehan. Rumble strips versus mumble strips.
Correct.
Which makes the nearby communities happier because it isn't as noisy, but still safe enough to alert that driver that, hey, you've crossed the line.
And that's what we're trying to balance, is how do we improve safety, but we don't compromise quality of life for those who live close to our state roads.
Well, Bernie, I really appreciate the call. Again, you can join us, 1-800 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. It's your chance to talk with the Commissioner of New Hampshire's Department of Transportation, Victoria Sheehan. Again, that number, 1-800-892-6477. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Here's an email from Peter in Mount Vernon, who says, it's almost axiomatic that you can travel north to south in our state easily, but east-west is difficult. I remember hearing this discussion with the mayor of Keene last week. He mentioned this. Are there any plans, Peter asks, long-term or otherwise, to create better east-to-west highway access? And we actually pulled a clip of that audio. We sat down with the mayors of three cities last week, and this came up, especially an issue for Kendall Lane, mayor of Keene. Let's hear a little bit about what Mayor Lane said about the problem of east-west travel in New Hampshire.
We're 20 miles from the nearest interstate, which is in Brattleboro, and it's difficult to travel east-west in the state of New Hampshire. Route 9 is our primary access, in certainly to Concord and to Manchester. Once again, it's not an interstate, and not having a major east-west highway is certainly a negative impact on our community and on the western part of the state.
Now, what about bus service, Mayor Lane?
You know, that's an issue. That we have daily north-south bus service going. It actually goes from White River Junction, stops in Keene, and goes to New York. But as far as east-west, that's very difficult. We recently were given a state subsidy for east-west bus service going through either Nashua or Concord, and we put it out to bid, and there were no takers.
Again, that's Keene Mayor Kendall Lane speaking on our show just recently. I was so struck by that, Commissioner Sheehan. They put out a bid to get east-west bus service, and nobody jumped in and said, yeah, I'd like to try that. Are you surprised by that?
Disappointed rather than surprised. It's challenging at times to help folks understand that the sources of revenue for transit services are limited, and fare box recovery is also not sufficient to cover the cost of operating a service.
That's the cost of the ticket,
the
basically.
Cost of the ticket.
It doesn't cover the cost of providing the service. Go ahead.
And so we work closely with the transit providers to understand what opportunities there are. But while there is often a demand for a service, how much demand is hard to estimate, and whether or not that service will truly be successful is debated. And so while we have on occasion piloted services, they haven't always proven to be successful. And that's always disappointing when we expand our offerings and then have to take something away.
So people say they want it, but not enough people show up.
Correct.
We always hear from listeners on this, Commissioner Sheehan, so I'm really glad that Peter raised it. What is the state's role in bus service? People often call and say, why doesn't the state provide this bus service, or why doesn't the state provide that bus service? My understanding, though, is that largely bus service is provided by private companies. So can you just explain what the state's role is in better bus service in New Hampshire?
So we've mentioned the state's highway our plan several times, but really it's the 10-year transportation plan. And we actually work with the legislature and the executive council and governor to prioritize how we're going to spend the transportation resources that are available to us. And through that 10-year plan process, we don't just program highway projects, we also allocate our federal transit dollars that we receive. And we work with 11 transit providers in the state and provide them assistance through the federal funding. They are services across various communities, from the urban providers such as Nashua Transit, Manchester Transit, to the more rural providers. And then, of course, we also operate the Boston Express bus service. That is operated under contract. We have a vendor that provides that service, but it is a state-run program. And so we do have a role to play in terms of advocating for transit services and working with our elected officials to understand how best to allocate the funding that we have received. But we talked about it earlier, there's different subcategories of funding. And so some money is specifically targeting urban transit systems, some funding is specifically targeting rural transit providers. And so there's competition for resources within these different subcategories.
And my understanding is that state gas taxes cannot be used for transit. Is that correct? It can only be used for roads. So that's a big chunk of change that you can't access for public transit.
Correct. We rely primarily on the Federal Transit Administration dollars.
So just to make sure I've got it clear, so some buses are run privately, completely. Some buses are sort of run privately, but they're under contract with the state, like the Boston Express, which goes down to Logan?
So some of the private companies that are very prevalent in the state are C&J, for example, on the Seacoast, or Concord Coach, Dartmouth Coach, serving other communities. Those are private services. But on occasion, they do work with the state to offer service to certain communities, and those particular routes can be eligible for federal funds. And so even the private bus companies may be accessing some of the federal dollars to be able to help us provide services in areas where we're targeting some investment.
Well, speaking of the Boston Express, which provides service down to Logan, and of course Concord Trailways out of Concord has buses to Logan all the time, and now to New York once a day, sometimes twice a day. Another theme that always comes up on this program, though, Commissioner Sheehan, when we've talked with you and other leaders in the state, is the lack of bus service to the Manchester Airport. And as you know, Manchester Airport has really taken a hit in the past decade. Its numbers are way down. I think passenger numbers are half of what they used to be. Earlier this year, we spoke with Ted Kitchens, director of the airport, and a listener called in fact, a bunch of listeners called in during the show saying, look, a big roadblock for us in using our own local airport is a lack of bus transportation. Let's hear Ted Kitchens on that.
Increasing the mass transit or the public transit options to the airport is something that is an item that we look into. It's not easy to change, you know, those type of agreements with the state. You know, I've talked to, you know, Commissioner Sheehan about this several times, and so it's something that we're going to investigate. We used to have an east-west bus service. My staff tells me this, and it got like two riders a day. This was not very feasible for us to continue that type of service.
Two riders a day, Commissioner Sheehan. Why is there such great bus service to Logan and no service to Manchester? And is providing that service really the state's role?
So there are private companies that are providing service to Boston and to Logan Airport in particular. The state, as I mentioned before, does provide the Boston Express service. That was really a commitment as part of the widening of I-93 to try and improve mobility along the corridor. We agreed to provide the Boston Express service primarily as a commuter service to access the city. But as part of that service, we also have buses that go out to Logan Airport. We work very closely with Director Kitchens, and while there has been efforts both by Manchester Transit and by the state to support other services, we just haven't seen the ridership to make them worthwhile. But at different times, different circumstances, we're still open to looking at those options.
Okay. Well, we will take a lot more of your calls after a short break. The number, 1-800-892-6477. Or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More with Transportation Commissioner Victoria Sheehan in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
Recently on The Exchange, we explored a particularly New Hampshire institution.
A town minus its general store has a huge hole in it, and people know that. Even if you don't stop at the general store, you want there to be one, because you know that that's like having the lights on. It's the pilot light of your town, and if it's out, you feel like there's something wrong.
The Exchange is your place for New Hampshire conversations. Every weekday at 9 a.m., only on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, we talk with John Peedy, chairman for the National Endowment for the Humanities. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, Victoria Sheehan is here, commissioner of New Hampshire's Department of Transportation. We're taking your comments and questions about how we get around in the Granite State. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Commissioner Sheehan, right back to our listeners. Let's go to New London, where David is on the line. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You've mentioned the 10-year plan several times, and I'm interested to learn a little bit more about what that is in terms of priorities or maybe some objectives or key action items. And I'm also wondering how connected or what level of connection does the 10-year plan have to economic development priorities for the state?
Great questions, David. Thank you so much. And we've sort of danced around this 10-year plan. We've mentioned it, but he's right. Let's hit it right on. What are the top three priorities, say, Commissioner Sheehan, in the department's 10-year plan?
So let me start by explaining the 10-year plan process and what the document is. So we will start work on our next update to the 10-year plan this summer with the Executive Council in what's called the GASET phase, which is the Governor's Advisory Committee on Intermodal Transportation, which essentially is the Executive Council working with the department. As part of that process, we'll have public hearings in every Executive Councillor's district. And that's what's really terrific about our 10-year plan process. It is really inclusive, and we go to every region of the state to try and understand what their transportation priorities are. We then work with the governor, who is able to update the plan, and then we work with the legislature. And ultimately, the plan becomes a piece of legislation. And it's the roadmap for the department. We don't advance a project unless it's in the 10-year plan. And that's why we put such an emphasis on that document and making sure that we get good public participation in the process. In the past, our 10-year plan was overprogrammed, so we've put a lot of emphasis on financial constraint. We want to set realistic expectations as to what our transportation system will look like in 10 years, given what we have for available revenue. And it's through the 10-year plan process that we make some of these tough decisions as to where we should be targeting our financial resources. And so the department works really hard to ensure that we are listening during the public process. We document all of the comments that we receive, whether it's testimony in person or written testimony. And we present that to both GASET and then to the legislature so that they can make informed choices as they set the priorities for New Hampshire.
So you're trying to keep this 10-year plan trim and reasonable, Commissioner Sheehan. I've heard past commissioners say the 10-year plan really is a 30-year plan because there's just too much stuff on it.
I think in the past, it was a 30-year plan. We had 30 years worth of projects squeezed into 10 years, and it wasn't a financially constrained document. And so people would advocate strongly for a project to be introduced into the plan, and then they would be very disappointed when we didn't have the financial resources to advance that project. And many times we ended up designing a lot of projects that just didn't move to construction in a timely fashion. And so with our new approach, we're trying to make sure that we are once again setting those realistic expectations as to what you can expect for services. And as I mentioned, the 10-year plan is our way of programming all of the different sources of funds that we have available for all the modes of transportation. Although because we have more money available for highway projects, a lot of the plan is focused on how to prioritize those dollars because there's more choices to be made. Oftentimes, we're assuming level funding, and so we're trying to maintain existing services and only expand when we really have the resources to do so.
So there's more money available because of that slight increase in the gas tax a couple years ago, Commissioner Sheehan, or why is that?
In the last federal finance bill, there was also an increase in funding.
I see.
Made available. We are starting this next 10-year plan, however, at a time where there's a lot of uncertainty. The current federal funding bill, the FAST Act, runs out in 2020, and so we'll be working with the Executive Council to understand what assumptions they want us to make this time around to ensure that we have that constrained document. But it really is a great process because it is so public, and I try to engage as many citizens as possible. We're really listening and trying to provide good customer service and target the highest priorities in different regions of the state. We actually start the process really early, working with the regional planning commissions. We make a certain amount of money available for new projects towards the end of the 10-year plan. And it's the regional planning commissions working with municipalities that help to identify the highest regional priorities. And we really respect that process. We try to support them and make sure that the estimates we have for those projects and the scope is well understood, and then use the public process to further vet those particular ideas.
So to our listeners' question, what are the top two or three or four priorities in this most recent iteration of the 10-year plan?
So we're really trying to stress preservation. We want to maintain our existing system first and provide our existing services and only expand when we have the resources to do so. We make mistakes when we try to build new and we don't take care of what we have. Many states across the country have fallen into this trap where we haven't preserved our infrastructure. And when we let it decline in condition, it can take anywhere between 4 times or 10 times as much money to get back to that same level of condition if we don't do the preventative maintenance. So if we want to be efficient as a department and spend the financial resources wisely, we want to do preventative maintenance and preservation at the right time. And so our 10-year plan ends up being a balance of preservation work, trying to address some of the needs, especially from a regional perspective. And then we also have some resources dedicated to our larger projects. And so one of our areas of focus is still the completion of projects like the I-93 widening between Salem and Manchester, and of course the construction of Exit 4A, a new interchange that has been a priority for the state for quite some time.
Let's go back to our listeners, Commissioner Sheehan. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. And Paul is in Berlin. Go ahead, Paul, you're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We in the North Country here, good majority of the population feel that we have been forgotten over the years as far as good roadways. Now, it's great up till 93, goes up to Franconia Notch, then hooks up with Littleton, and that's fine. And from the seacoast, Route 16, it's good up beyond Rochester. Then the same old thing. And a lot of businesses, industry, hesitate to come up here because of lack of good roadways. Any plans upcoming in the future to maybe consider making things better for us? Thank you very much.
Paul, I'm so glad you called, and I want to let you and everyone know that Steve in Madison also sent us a similar note. He says, I live in northern New Hampshire and drive many rural miles, mostly on local town roads. Steven says, I would think there are many like me who live rural and therefore must drive more miles than those in the cities. The idea that was proposed of pay per mile tax or chip tracking taxes, how can those tax dollars go toward my local roads rather than always being funneled to southern New Hampshire highways? So Stephen in Madison and Paul in Berlin are expressing, Commissioner Sheehan, a feeling that we often hear in more rural parts of the state. It feels like the southern roads are perfectly smooth and people in North Country are bumping all over the place.
So as part of our 10-year plan process, we show a lot of the charts and graphics that explain the current condition of our system. And what you will see is that our high-volume roadways in New Hampshire are in very good condition overall. That's primarily because they're either turnpike funded or they are eligible for federal dollars. And because they are the roads that carry the majority of the traffic, the state has prioritized their investments in those particular corridors. And so when you look at the lower volume roadways, that's where we have declining condition. And many of those roads are not eligible for federal funding. We're much more reliant on state funds to preserve those particular roadways. And so that's why, as part of the 10-year plan process, we try to help people understand what segments of roadway are competing with each other when we talk about available funding. Now, all of that being said, we have worked with the legislature to correct some of the unintended consequences of prior legislation. So one small change that we made was, to our betterment program. And so that is money that is targeted for state routes in particular. Many of these are the roads that aren't eligible for federal funding. And previously, we had a formula that allocated those dollars that didn't take into consideration some of the inequities that we see. Sometimes our bid prices, for example, are higher when we do work in the North Country because it's not as convenient for contractors to access that area, or transportation of materials increases costs. And so we worked with the legislature to give the department some authority to try to strive for regional equity from a condition perspective rather than regional equity from a dollar perspective, so that we could spend a little bit more in the communities where we see a higher cost when we advance either maintenance or construction projects.
Oh, that's really interesting. Okay, well, Stephen and the caller from Berlin, thank you very much. Important point that often comes up when we talk about transportation. John on Facebook asks, why doesn't DOT use roundabouts more to manage traffic? Now, I'm guessing you don't have roundabouts on major highways, obviously, but what about the use of roundabouts on the smaller roads like Route 3, 3A, 9, and so forth?
The department has been building more roundabouts. When we go out and work with the community on an intersection improvement project, a roundabout is often the preferred solution. In general, roundabouts are safer. While you may see minor accidents, the severe accidents are significantly reduced with roundabouts because of the nature of how a roundabout operates. And so there are many communities that are willing to partner with us and identify that a roundabout is the right solution.
So you have to sort of figure it out with the community and look at the numbers and how many cars or trucks and
we look
how
carefully
fast
at the existing traffic volumes, what we're projecting into the future. And as with every aspect of our work, we're striving for the safest solution. And often it is a roundabout. But of course, we're constrained by right-of-way and environmental impacts. And so there's a number of different factors that contribute to the decision-making process.
All right. Well, thank you for that email. And let's go back to the callers. Bill is calling in from Rumney. Go ahead, Bill. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question for the commissioner. A route that I take quite frequently involves a small state road making a T-intersection with a much more heavily traveled state road. And many people who have to drive through this intersection are concerned that it's just a matter of time till there's a fatal accident at this point. How can we most effectively raise this concern with the Department of Transportation?
Bill, thank you for the question. And how can people talk to you guys about specific concerns that they have about specific areas?
So you can write to us directly, and we will look into the issue and respond with the appropriate way to advance a project. Sometimes people come to us with issues in their community and it's not necessarily a state route that we're discussing. But the other way is through the 10-year plan process. Because we have these public hearings across the state, that is an opportunity to come forward and identify any concerns you have with the roadways in your region.
Dan from Concord asks, what are the plans to widen I-93 through Concord? And Dan, I'm glad you wrote because I wanted to ask you about that project in general. Specifically, there's some concerns about the impact on Concord and its attempts to reconnect with the river. So we'll address that in a minute. But what about the wider issue of the I-93 widening? Why is that so important? The state's been talking about this for years and working on it for years.
So one of the reasons I am passionate about working in transportation is because of the impact that it has on both our quality of life and our economy.
Yeah, and actually an earlier caller mentioned economic development. So
We don't just build infrastructure for infrastructure's sake. We recognize that the services that we provide, they're essential. You can't get to work, you can't get to school, you can't get to your doctor's appointment without the transportation system. And so our work is impacting folks on a daily basis. And when it comes to how we should prioritize our investments, it is often economic development that influences which regions we invest in. And people are focused on how much we spend on transportation. I try to rephrase that as how much we are investing in transportation. And because you look at the opportunity that's come from the widening of I-93 with the major development that's now planned along that corridor, from Tuscan Village in Salem, there's the Gateway Project in Wyndham, and then we have Woodmont Commons proposed in Londonderry.
These are sort of multi-use, multi-types of facilities, apartments, shopping, offices, and so forth.
Yes, it's that balance of work-life play and trying to provide economic opportunity along the corridor.
So I-93 is important because the widening is important because it will spur economic opportunity or because people are stuck in traffic now? Or what is it, Commissioner
Sheehan? It's both. We had significant delays, especially on Friday evenings and Sunday evenings as visitors were coming in and out of our state. And so we want to ensure that we're providing access throughout New Hampshire. We recognize that as Massachusetts becomes more congested and many of our visitors are coming up for the weekend, not necessarily for a longer stay, we want to make sure you can travel freely through New Hampshire and get to your destination as quickly as possible.
How do you feel about the build it and they will come phenomenon, Commissioner Sheehan? The idea that if you keep widening the roads, people keep driving and eventually those new lanes will just be crowded up again.
There's been a concern around this approach for many, many years. And that's why the department has been committed to multimodal transportation options. As part of the I-93 project, for example, I mentioned our commitment to the Boston Express service during construction. We've also worked closely with the local transit providers. We want to protect that investment as well. And we want to make sure that when we invest significantly in these corridors, we get as much value out of that investment as possible. which means we want free travel. And so travel demand management and trying to encourage different types of development, it's part of our goal as an agency as well.
Well, and I have to ask you this because we always get questions from listeners. What is the status right now, Commissioner Sheehan? This has gone back and forth of putting in a rail corridor somewhere along that I-93 corridor.
The Capital Corridor Rail Project has been greatly debated in New Hampshire. At this stage, there are members of the legislature that would like us to proceed with the next phase, which is the project development phase of the project. So we would complete the design, develop the environmental permits, and most importantly, develop a financial plan so that we would understand the true costs of both construction as well as operating the system. We've talked a lot about transit service today and how it's hard to cover the cost of providing those services. And so if New Hampshire was to move forward with rail, our job as DOT is to educate our legislature so they can make informed decisions. So making sure that they have the information they need to determine whether or not New Hampshire can afford a rail project is important. So if we move forward with this next phase, then that financial plan would be the most important aspect of our work.
So that's an if.
Well, it's, as I mentioned before, the department uses the 10-year plan as our guiding document, and right now that particular project is not in our current 10-year plan.
So you are basically following what the legislature and governor tell you to do in this 10-year plan. And from what I understand, this rail has been kind of a political football. It gets put in, it gets taken out, it gets put in, it gets taken out.
Yes, we've gone back and forth. And so the department, you know, is following this legislative session closely to see what happens.
Well, Commissioner Sheehan, you have to come back because we had lots of emails and calls that we didn't even get to. So thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Great to be here, and I'd happily come back again. Thank you.
That's Victoria Sheehan. She's Commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Transportation, and this is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.